Happy to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Thanks for listening. I'm sitting in for Larry Mueller today, and so glad to have you along on Memorial Day. As is often the case, we are going to talk about birds on our holiday today. Birds are such a wonder to watch and to listen to. Even if you're just listening to what's around you when you're running errands or maybe working in the garden, there's so much to take in. But how do we know what we're actually hearing? So today we have two experts who can talk us through that and give us some great pointers. Noel Cutright is a past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. Noel, thanks so much for spending your holiday with us.
And to some of your listeners.
And it's really great to have you. And I think we just lost Bill Volkert, so we'll get him back on the phone. But Noel, I know that you've been out doing a lot of the Great Wisconsin Birdathons that have been going on. What have you been seeing?
Well, it's been an interesting spring, as I'm sure your listeners would agree. You know, March was unbelievably warm, and we had a number of migrants coming into the state early, even though the bulk of those populations came pretty much on time. Then April, we were kind of in a holding pattern. You know, it was a little bit cooler, pretty much typical April. Now it seems like we're in late June versus late May because all the vegetation's out. Everything is flowering. Many of the birds are in the middle of their first nesting, and it's just been really interesting to be out and around the state. And as you mentioned, I have been in several locations, but today I'm coming actually from Governor Dodge State Park, where I'm with 15 other members of the River Edge Bird Club on our two-day Southwest Wisconsin birdwatching trip.
Wow, that's great. And we do have Bill now on the line. Hi, Bill. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Judith. My pleasure.
And Bill was, for 27 years, a naturalist at Horicon Marsh, and he's been birding for nearly 40 years. And Bill, I just saw this on your website, which is billvolkert.com. In your travels, you have sighted more than 2,500 species. That's a quarter of the world's birds. That's amazing.
Well, you know, birds is a fascination, and as I've always told people, if you follow the birds, whether it's in Wisconsin or somewhere out of the country, not only are you going to see just some great cross-section of very vivid wildlife, but they'll also take you to some of the best places in the world, too.
Well, that's great, and we have so much to talk about today. So, as you were alluding to, Noel, this has been a very strange spring. Really warm March, then returning more or less to normal temperatures in April, which felt really cool compared to that warm March. It also seems like it's been quite dry. So how has all of that affected our birds, both our migratory birds and the birds that are here year-round?
I think it's kind of difficult to say because each species will react differently. And as you said, we came past a number of wetlands and ponds today on our way over from southeast Wisconsin. And a number of the ponds are drawn down. There's quite a bit of exposed dirt, mud along the edges. So we do need some rain. But every species will react differently. Some, you know, life goes on pretty much. They're pretty well adapted to react favorably to most anything that comes. Others, I guess, remains to be seen how the rest of the breeding season goes before we really know exactly how successful or productive a nesting season has been for our birds.
So if birds come back early because of the conditions where they're coming from, that's one thing. But, I mean, do they know somehow in advance that things are warming up here, or does it really depend where they're coming back from?
It depends a lot where they're coming back from. And of course, we have noticed there's been a number of studies now showing that birds are reacting to changes in our climate, and in general, we're seeing, you know, earlier blooming seasons for many of our plants. We're seeing birds reacting by arriving back earlier. We're seeing more and more shifts in arrival dates, I think, with time. And of course, we're seeing this not only in Wisconsin but elsewhere in the United States and North America, and certainly in Europe, too, where they're keeping track of this.
And Bill?
Well, as far as the spring migration goes, I mean, certainly the birds reacted to the weather. And in March, we certainly had record early dates for a lot of birds. But I think the important thing to keep in mind is spring migration starts already back in February, early March for the earliest migrants. And we're now at the end of May just seeing the last of the migrants either arriving here in Wisconsin and certainly moving out of southern Wisconsin and arriving in northern Wisconsin. So as you mentioned earlier, the weather, it really slowed down and cooled off in mm-hmm. April. So the birds that were moving at that time were stalled out.
Ah, okay.
And so we had this surge of the early migrants, things like hermit thrushes and fox sparrows just blew through southern Wisconsin. And then everything stalled out through much of April. And as we got toward the latter part of April, bird watchers were actually waiting for birds. They were held back. And now we fell a little behind the schedule. And then all of a sudden there's this rush, and we're making up for lost time, and things were really compressed. Rather than coming in kind of a nice sequence, it's like the floodgates opened, and birds were just rushing through in those first couple of weeks of May. And now we're settling into that end of the migration and the beginning of the nesting season for most birds, and as Noel mentioned, some of them already have got their young out, some of the early nesters, and where they're already starting on the second brood.
And so those birds, those baby birds that perhaps were born a little early, does that give them any kind of advantage then going into the fall migration?
Well, any of the birds are going to have a long time to develop. I mean, you just go down to your local park and watch Canada geese, how quickly those things go from something that barely fits in the palm of your hand to right now already a half-grown goose, and by July fully grown and feathered out. It only takes 2 months for even something as big as a Canada goose to be full grown.
Wow.
And then to develop the flight feathers and the strength and ability to be able to fly. Some birds, like owls, it's more the perfecting of hunting skills, so they start nesting quite early in the year. And it takes a long time to get proficient at finding your own food and before the winter sets in again, because most of those owls don't migrate.
Mm-hmm.
Other birds, like, say, a little wren, they can pull off laying of the eggs, hatching of those young in less than 12 days, and about the same amount of time in the nest, kick those young out, and then start another family once they have fledged those birds. Feed the young a little bit outside, give them a little bit of care, and then on their own, and start a second family. So it's a short summer in Wisconsin, but yeah, they pull off an awful lot of young, or at least a lot of nesting attempts. There's always the nest losses and loss of young.
Sure.
Which is why there's such high reproduction.
So you two are saying that the spring migration back to Wisconsin generally starts late February, ends around mid-May. Where do the warblers fit in there? It seems like a lot of people are, you know, really wait anxiously for the warblers. What is it about them that make them so appealing?
Well, there are so many of them, and they have such different behaviors, different plumages, different songs. I mean, on a really, really, really good day in Wisconsin, if you're really out there and visiting a lot of different places, you can find 30 different species of warblers. So it's a challenge, but they're fun just because of the variety they do provide. And many of them are coming from the tropics, even though we have a few that overwinter in the southern United States and don't have that long a journey to get back. Many of them are coming all the way from the tropics, either Central America, all the way down into Panama, maybe a few all the way from northern South America.
Wow.
So, and, you know, some of these don't even breed in Wisconsin. They get here and they spend maybe a few weeks with us, but they're moving on into southern Canada to breed. And, of course, some of these guys are going pretty far north into the boreal forest to breed.
Wow. So. And these are very small birds. I mean, when you think of the length of that journey, and these are tiny little birds.
The average length for our warblers from the beak to the tail, maybe 4 to 4.5 inches.
Wow, that's amazing.
And their weights, we're looking at 12 to 15 grams, maybe a third to a half of an ounce. And then they'll put on a good amount of fat on top of that as their fuel. And as you mentioned, when are they arriving? They actually come in sequence. Even among those 30-some species of warblers, there is a sequence to them. The yellow-rumped warbler is an odd one. It comes much earlier, sort of out of sync of everyone else. Early, mid-April, they're here. Sometimes even the end of March, we'll see the first one showing up. And then as we get into that last part of April, the last 10 days or so, we start seeing the palm warbler, black-throated green, black and white, pine warbler. And then those first 2 weeks of May, that's all of a sudden when the hummingbirds and orioles are here, we get this flood of warblers. As Noel mentioned, on a good morning, you can get out and find 15, 20, 25 species or more when things are really hopping. And some will remain in southern and even northern Wisconsin for nesting, and others keep right on moving. But there's that little window when everybody shows up at once. And on a good spring day, things are just alive. I've already had a single tree with a dozen species.
Wow. That's amazing. Well, one of the things we wanted to do today is play some bird calls and songs to help people kind of train their ears and for you two to help us. So since we're talking about warblers, let's actually listen to a yellow warbler. Here's a little audio. So, Bill, let's start with you. What are you hearing there?
Not much.
Yeah, it didn't come through real.
It didn't come through.
Oh, all right. Well, we'll try to work on that for later. I'm sorry about that. Well, let's go to the phone because we have Ivy in Evansville. Hi, Ivy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to put in a plug for our public hunting grounds. I not only hunt there, but I watch birds. And the other day I was walking along an old rail bed, and there was a young woodcock. It was still in down, and it was just so cute. But I see all kinds of birds there, like cedrens and warblers, and in the winter, short-eared owls and harriers. And these places are really special. They don't look spectacular, say like Devil's Lake, but they're really important for wildlife and bring me a lot of joy, and I'm sure other people who go out there. But thank you for being on.
Great. Thanks, Ivy.
Yeah. Bye.
That's a good point, because this morning our first birding stop was down in the southern Kellermarine State Forest around the Mackey picnic area, and then we proceeded on to the Brooklyn State Wildlife Area, and we have plans to stop at Albany. So we have a number of state wildlife areas. People don't really think of them too much because they're always thinking about state parks, but they're wonderful places for a multitude of recreational activities in the outdoors. So there's maps available from the DNR on where these are, and I would suggest try to visit some in your neighborhood, or when you're out traveling around the state, include a few on your itinerary.
And public lands are really important for conservation because many of them are devoted to actual management of wildlife habitats. Some of them are very large properties, so that they provide for very large populations of wildlife. And the other good thing is that they're publicly accessible. So these are places that not only harbor wildlife, and many of them intentionally manage to protect wildlife, but places where people can go and see and enjoy them, too. And we got lots of great places in Wisconsin.
Great. Thanks for that call. Let's go to Jilly in Wanderers. Hi, Jilly.
Hi, good day. Thank you. And if I may take the opportunity to thank our service people and their families.
Certainly.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Okay, question. Last spring, we could not have been more thrilled to have purple martins move into our martin house. As a child in the 60s, they were everywhere. All the houses were full. In the fall, we changed the house, and we saw them come this spring and check it out, and again, we were thrilled, and they chose not to stay. So we're wondering if it's about that we changed the house.
No, I don't think so. You know, as you mentioned, purple martins have really declined significantly here in Wisconsin over the last few decades, and there's some real interest in getting some conservation activities directed specifically for purple martins to try to encourage their numbers. And it's a very frustrating bird for a lot of hopeful purple martin landlords, because they keep trying and trying and trying without success. And like you, sometimes you'll have success, and then for apparently no reason at all, they don't show up again the next year. I wouldn't give up totally yet, because there are still some of the young birds coming back. They very often don't get here until real late May, early June.
Oh, great. Thank you. That's good to know.
So don't give up hope completely. But
no, not at all.
What you did to your house is probably didn't have an effect, but it's one of those things that all you can do sometimes is cross your fingers and hope.
All right. Well, thanks so much. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, for some good hints of anybody who has purple martins, as Noel said, is a bird of real concern, and we need to have conscientious landlords, in other words, people who have active boxes that are raising purple martins, go to the Purple Martin Conservation Association website. Lots of useful information on establishing houses for them, maintaining them, luring them, and also reasons why sometimes they fail or where people are successful. That's a great place for people to go, and we do need good, conscientious landlords, because the Purple Martin in the eastern United States is entirely dependent on the housing that humans provide.
Yeah, Minnesota and Michigan both have Purple Martin working groups, and I expect sometime the next year we're going to see something like that happen in Wisconsin. In the southeastern part of the state, we just had a recent group start up in the Plymouth-Sheboygan area, and they're quite active and put out. They meet six or eight times a year, have a newsletter, and there's so much enthusiasm. I've attended one of their meetings and getting their website up where people can visit. So there are definitely some actions going on and will be going on here soon to address Purple Martin specifically.
Thanks for that call, Jilly. And you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Larry today. We're talking about birds with Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert. More coming up soon. Thanks again for joining us here on Memorial Day. As often we do on holidays, we are talking about birds and bird watching with Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert. Noel is a past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, and Bill Volkert has been watching and studying birds for nearly 40 years. He was a naturalist at Horicon Marsh for 27 of those years. Always great to have both of you on. And Noel, I haven't asked you, how long have you been bird watching?
I tell people I've been looking at birds for 68 years, because that's my age. I grew up in southern Ohio. I was born in December, as you might be able to tell from my first name.
Oh, there you go.
We had a very, very large window feeder right over the kitchen sink in our house in Ohio. It was in a state park, matter of fact.
Oh, wow.
And my mother used to give my first infant bath in the kitchen sink. And she said she could do anything she wanted to me, because I'm always looking into birds on that window feeder.
As long as there were birds there, you could.
Rather than having
you would sit there.
A mobile over your crib, I had the real thing with a foot away from me. So I
wow.
tell people I started then and continued all my life.
Wow. Well, we're glad that both of you have been watching birds for so long, because I think whether someone's a novice like me or very experienced, the two of you have great information to share. And actually, let's try another bird call, and we'll see. Hopefully you two will be able to hear it this time. We wanted to both feature common birds and some more unusual birds in Wisconsin. Some birds have been declining, but one that is certainly very common, and I have to say is one of my favorites, is a black-capped chickadee. So let's listen to the chickadee. So what sets that chickadee apart from some of the other birds we might hear?
Well, the common phrase for that is calling like peewee. The little confusion there is we also have a flycatcher called the eastern wood peewee. What's interesting with the chickadee is most birds in their call notes, in other words, the communication between individuals that they do throughout the year, tend to be very simple, the little chip, chatter, peeps, and so forth, where the songs are the more complex. The chickadee is the opposite. Most of that chickadee-dee-dee and the gurgles and chips and everything else we hear out of them, those are communication calls. The song is just that two-note, little pee-wee, bee-bee. That's all it is, but that is the song. And so this is something people hear all around Wisconsin. They see chickadees throughout, especially the wintertime, and don't oftentimes associate that common bird. That's the song that we hear in spring into early summer.
And I just love watching them. There's something about them that are so cheery, and they kind of flit about, and the black and gray and white. I just really enjoy watching them at the feeders.
Yeah, I think I know why you played it.
Oh, yes, exactly. Now, could you two hear that time?
Not really.
Not very well, but I see on your Facebook, it said that the Yellow Warbler song came through well on the radio, so apparently your listeners are picking it up.
Okay.
Go right ahead. If we're not picking it up, we'll
still talk about it.
Okay.
We'll make something up.
Okay. Well, that's what we like in a good radio guest, always the ability to make something up. Well, John in Green Bay is next. Hi, John. What's your question?
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Question, is there any way to attract pileated woodpeckers? I live on the northeast side of Green Bay, heavily wooded area. I've got a pileated woodpecker. I've seen them once. And I have a very active feeder, a large selection of birds, including woodpeckers. but I'd like to see the pileated a little more often.
Well, it's certainly a spectacular bird, and I certainly see why you would like to have them around close to your house. They will occasionally come to suet, but I mean, there's more feeders out there that have suet that never attract a pileated woodpecker than ones that do.
Yeah, I've got suet. I've got suet all over, right?
And have a place where they are. Why they come in sometimes and others don't, I have no idea. But it's a species that is increasing in Wisconsin. In fact, significantly over the last few years. So all you can do is keep trying and live in a nice wooded area. And
yeah, I can hear him. You know, I hear him
sure.
away, and I hear his voice. Just one other comment. I've never had a squirrel on my feeder. I've had that feeder up for almost 12 years. I've never had one of those varmints.
They try
constantly, but they've never got to my feeder.
Well, that's pretty amazing. If you're living in a wooded area where you have a lot of woodpeckers and so forth, obviously you have a lot of trees, and it's just it's hard to believe you don't have a squirrel, but I certainly believe you.
So in that area where John lives near Green Bay, is that a good location to see and hear pileated woodpeckers?
Yeah, they're distributed.
Got extensive forest.
Okay.
Right. They're distributed around the state. They're less common in the agricultural southern part, but even there we have enough woodlands and other areas that they're not uncommon. When I moved to Wisconsin in 1977, we had one pair of pileated woodpeckers in Ozaukee County, which is just immediately north of Milwaukee County. You know, a pretty urban, built-up area with some ag, not a whole lot of natural areas. But now we have probably 8 or 10 pairs of pileated spread around, and even down into like a Schlitz-Audubon Nature Center down in the northern part of Milwaukee County. So we're seeing more and more pileated even in the southern part of the state than we used to.
And I think that's because the forests are maturing. We're
right.
Seeing a nice increase in the habitat that's available to them.
And John mentioned squirrels on the bird feeder. Yesterday, I was looking out at one of the bird feeders in my backyard, and a chipmunk had actually made his way up there and was filling the pockets in his cheeks with from the finch feeder.
Yeah, wait till fall time, and when he starts stowing it away, you'll see them going out with their jowls just full of
feet. Yeah.
I'm quite convinced that there really is no such thing as a squirrel-proof bird feeder. Some are more resistant than others, but I guess John's just playing lucky. He doesn't have the squirrel
yeah.
at the feeder. It's a tough one when you put food out for birds and everybody else finds it.
And hopefully the squirrels aren't listening because they're going to know that there's not much competition there.
Yeah, they'll be over. He's off to next.
Well, thanks for that call. And let's go next to Lee, north of Green Bay. Hi, Lee.
Yeah, good morning. This is always such a great show.
Well,
I
thanks.
Enjoy it. This is a question I have on the bluebird and putting up their houses. When should and can, I'm about 15 miles north of Green Bay, I've got about 20 acres here. When is about the latest that a person should be putting up those bluebird houses?
You can actually still be putting them up because the first brood of bluebirds is underway right now. I know there's a number of my friends already have hatched bluebirds and they're out. They will re-nest a second time. And a lot of these bluebirds this year got an early start. It's not beyond the realm of possibility of having 3 broods here in the state this year, especially in the southern part of the state. So you still have bluebirds searching for 4 boxes into, through June. So if you have some, you just haven't gotten them up yet, I would go ahead and place them out. But typically you want them out, pretty early in April.
Okay. Well, thanks for that, Colly. And you can join in, too, if you have a question or comment or a sighting of birds to share. We would love to hear from you. You can call 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@WPR.org, or you can go to our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mehler Show, and Mehler is spelled M-E-I-L-L-E-R. And actually, one of our coworkers, Michael Leland, who is the WPR news director, shared a photo that he took of a sandhill crane parent and colt that he took this morning in Madison. And it's a lovely picture. So if you go to our Facebook page, you can see that. We've had a few emails here. So let's go to an email from Janice in Fort Atkinson. She says, my husband and I have noticed woodpeckers in our town that perch on television antennae and hammer away on the plastic covers attached to them. Why would they be attracted to such a thing? We thought it was maybe an isolated bird, but we've noticed them in other neighborhoods doing the same thing.
Well, woodpeckers have an interesting habit, and they don't have a real good vocalization. You'll hear the little pips and chatters out of the woodpeckers. These are the contact calls and warning calls, but for many of them, they don't produce an actual song. So in other words, that drilling or drumming you hear is a substitute for the song. They're establishing their territory, and they're announcing that way. So they're looking in nature for a tree with a real nice, hollow, resonant sound to it. And the different woodpeckers, actually, you can pick them out by the different drumming that they do. The very light rhythmic tapping of a downy woodpecker, this what I call Morse code, the irregular tapping of sapsuckers, or that real deep, almost like a boot kicking a stump for a pileated woodpecker. And so they're looking for something with good resonance, and sometimes gutters or hollow tubing or something like this, they'll give an experiment. I had a sapsucker a number of years ago using a wood duck box just because it sounded like a speaker. You know, it just sounded good and carried the sound.
How did the wood duck feel about that?
He wasn't in there yet, or she wasn't. So, yeah, they're looking for really something to advertise. It's got a great resonance.
So it's really, they're using it as a musical instrument.
Yeah, I guess so.
Wow.
Yeah, I have a breeding bird survey up in Marinette County I've been doing for 25 years. And one of my stops, there's a stop sign with a wooden fence post and, of course, a metal sign. And about 90% of the time I'm there, once a year I'm there in June, there's a sapsucker that's perched or clinging to the wooden post and rapping on that sign. And the reverberation of that sound, you can hear it for hundreds of yards away. So he's found him a good spot, and he knows it and visits it year after year.
Let's go next to Mike in Whitewater. He also has a bluebird question. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I have had a bluebird box up for about 16 years, and every year I get a nesting pair of bluebirds, build a nest, and then almost every year the tree swallows will drive the bluebirds out and pick the box. This year the bluebirds were early. They got their nest built. I had five eggs in it. They hatched five babies out. And then about a week ago, I looked, and here the tree swallows have built a nest on top of the baby bluebirds, and they were all dead. And I don't know what to do about this. I mean,
yeah, that's a tough one. What, Noah, what do you think?
I'm not sure there is a whole lot you can do. Typically, when bluebirds make it to that stage in their nesting cycle, they'll be able to withstand the onslaught of the persistent tree swallows. But I don't know what might be happening that you're going that many years without having any success. And like this year, like you had baby birds in the nest, I'm surprised that they weren't able to ward off tree swallows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I even put another house down the fence line away, and I thought that would solve it. I thought because the tree swallows seemed to have put a nest in there. And I thought, boy, there's the solution. And then all of a sudden, they built a nest on top of the babies, and they all died. And, of course, I keep tearing the nest out, so they finally go away. And this happens every single year, and I just don't know what to do about it.
Well, one thing we do find is that in the eastern and southeastern part of Wisconsin, where we have a prevalence of wetlands, this is where we've got, of course, a lot of flying insects, which is food for the tree swallows and good habitat for them. With abundant tree swallow population in that part of the state, yeah, bluebirds are under a lot of pressure. It seems that people in the central part of Wisconsin, around Stevens Point and out to the west central part of the state, seem to have a much higher success. There's not as much good habitat for the tree swallows, and the bluebirds seem to do better. I was going to suggest a couple of extra boxes maybe to provide a little alternative, but that doesn't always solve it either. The Bluebird Restoration Association of Wisconsin, again, another good source to go to for some information. See if somebody else might have some hints there. Otherwise, just keep trying.
Yeah. Sorry about that, Mike. It sounds like a tough situation. But let's go to Ellen and Waupun next. Hi, Ellen.
Hello. I'm wondering about just our backyard birdhouses for wrens and chickadees and so on. Do they need to be cleaned out from year to year?
Typically, it was recommended that you do so, yes.
And have you cleaned them out before, Ellen?
No, we haven't. And will they not nest in them if there's old debris in there?
Well, they will use them.
Yes, they will.
Part of the nesting and pair bonding is that building of the nest So it's nice to give them a little bit of space so they can, again, just build that nest itself. And you may have the problem of old debris providing habitat for some of the nest parasites. Mm.
And so,
they want to clean those out.
So what's the best time of year to clean birdhouses out? Is it in the fall just as the birds have left, or is it early in the spring before they're setting up their nest?
I prefer in spring, and main reason is because some boxes will also be inhabited by deer mice over the winter time. So, yeah, spring's always a good time. In March, just as things are thawing, you're getting ready to, for the birds arriving, good time to go out and clean everything out and get it set for the birds.
Okay, great. Thanks for that call. Oh, go ahead.
Sometimes the nest will accumulate moisture depending on how it's set and so forth, and I think sometimes if you leave the nest in there all winter, it can lead to the deterioration of the wood. So I typically try to visit both in fall and spring. Once maybe to get the nest out, and then if a flying squirrel or a white-footed mice at mouse, as Bill mentioned, gets in, you can clean that out in the spring, too.
Now, I've never put a birdhouse up. If I'm really not sure what birds are on, like, for instance, I don't know if we have bluebirds in central Madison or, you know, other kinds of birds that there are specific types of boxes or houses for. If I wanted to put up kind of a generic birdhouse, what would I do? Where should I put it? What kind of box or house is right? Bill?
Well, the bluebird box, that size hole works well for bluebirds, tree swallows, chickadees, wrens occasionally will take advantage of them as well. So those work well. The one concern I would have is we know that there's a lot of competition from our non-native birds, house sparrows and starlings. So if you're putting up boxes, you want to make sure you're targeting for benefit of the native birds.
Okay.
And that's also been a reason why we see a collapse of a lot of our purple martin colonies. People don't tend them well enough. And all of a sudden, you've got the starlings getting into there. And, in fact, I just saw this spring a martin house that was in use for many years, and it's collapsed. The starlings are all over it, and the martins were circling it, but I don't think they're going to nest this year. It looks like they've abandoned it. So you want to make sure you target a little bit.
Okay.
And the Northern Prairie Research Center website has excellent plans for everything from a small wren house up to an osprey and eagle platforms. Anything you can imagine building to help birds, that's a really good site for that.
And you said that's the Northern Prairie Research Center?
Yes.
Okay, well, Amanda will put that up for us.
Okay.
All right, great. And we are talking about birds with Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert. As we do often on holidays, we're talking about bird watching and improving our skills and learning how to appreciate those wonderful parts of the Wisconsin landscape. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. And Nancy emailed, kind of staying along the nesting theme here. We have two robin's nests below our deck that appear to be empty and no longer used. Is it the right time of the season to remove the nests, or are they still being used? I don't want to disturb the possibility of a second brood if robins actually have more than one.
They will often have more than one, but I would go ahead and, you know, if they've been not been used for a week or two, she can go ahead. Nancy can go ahead and remove them. Fine.
Okay, great. And let's go to Mary in Madison next. Hi, Mary.
Hello.
Yes. What's your question?
Yes. Identification between a. Let's see. I gotta get it here. Let's see. Cooper's hawk and a sharp-shinned hawk.
Okay. So, how to tell them apart?
Now, I've narrowed it down to these two, and I don't have a tail identification because I wasn't sharp enough to pick up on that until I read about them, and now I don't see them anymore. But in profile, I saw a white feather very distinct on the lower side.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And would that be a Cooper's or a sharp shin?
Yeah, they'll very often show that so-called skirt. So I would say you were looking at a Cooper's hawk. But those two species are very difficult to tell apart. In fact, you know, you look at the field guide, oh, one's much bigger than the other. But when you start looking at them, you don't have a lot to compare with. And when you can actually have overlap, a large female sharpshin can be as large as a small male Cooper's hawk. Mm. It's not easy, but especially in the Madison area, I would guess it probably was a Cooper's hawk. They tend to be a little bit more common in nesting in our urban parks. I tell people in Milwaukee County there's probably a Cooper's hawk nesting in every county park in the whole county that has any kind of woods at all. So,
wow. Don't hang up on me, please. So that white, very distinct, long white feather was definitely a Cooper's hawk in profile?
Well, it's more than one feather. It's a group of feathers that shows up kind of in the lower flank,
yes,
in between the tail and the wing. But they do often, we call it a skirt, but it's a, I don't even know what track of feathers that is, Bill. But that just seems a little bit more noticeable in a Cooper's hawk than a sharpshin.
Okay, great. Thank you.
All right, thanks for that call, Mary. And let's go to Judy in Lodi next. Hi, Judy.
Hi, I have a question. We've had bird feeders out where I live here. It's an apartment building for years, and we had a little bit of problems. And the office that manages the building told us we had to take all the bird feeders down. And I think it's going to hurt the birds coming winter and fall because they're used to coming here. And in the meantime, my daughter was visiting me, and we saw the smallest bird I have ever seen. I thought it was a baby bird, but it flew, so it wasn't a baby bird. And I don't know what it was. I've got very bad eyesight. I just had eye surgery, and I don't know what it was. My daughter didn't either. She's an avid bird watcher.
And what color was it, Judy?
It was like a tan and a darker tan.
Mm-hmm.
But it was very, very small, and it was beautiful to me because it was real close to the window so I could see it.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's see what Bill and Noel think. So we've got the small tannish bird at the feeder, and then also the issue of feeding birds year-round and if that's really going to hurt those birds that have gotten used to coming to her feeder.
Well, my guess for the tiny birds, the smallest one that besides hummingbirds, is the kinglet. And they've just migrated through here over the last few weeks. That would be my guess. They're kind of grayish overall. The ruby crown kinglet tends to be the more common one we see in backyards. These things would make a chickadee look big. It is a small bird.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they're incredibly tiny. And I've banded them. I've had them in the hands. And that is a small thing to have. That would be my guess for that bird.
Okay.
I don't know if Noel's got another guess on it.
Well, I would agree, but, you know, it could even be something like a red-breasted nuthatch, which is really a showy bird, you know, brown creepers. But kinglet's what came into my mind first when she started to describe it.
Okay.
Just from its tiny size. As far as the bird feeding, studies have shown this, that even in wintertime, when birds are probably under the greatest pressure for the need of food, still something like 80% of the food that they obtain comes from the wild.
Okay.
So, really, our bird feeding is to bring the birds in close so we can enjoy them. I'm sure that it is probably critical for birds in severe weather and storms when snow and ice cover up the natural food and they're under more pressure, high winds, low temperatures, puts a drain on birds. Sure, these are probably really important at that time. But overall, it's more of a convenience and I encourage people to do bird feeding because, you know, it's a way to be able to see them and enjoy mm-hmm. them and get interested in birds. But overall, I think most people would say we do it more for us than we do for the birds. They've always gotten by just fine just with the food that's out there, and that's where they get most of it. But, hey, it's like a fast food stop. It's always convenient. It's there. And when you really need it, it's available mm-hmm. for the birds.
Great.
Well, Judith, I can give you a weather report here also from Dodge. It's thundering and lightning, blowing and raining pretty hard. So,
all right.
Governor Dodge State Park has about 300 campsites, so I bet there's some people
scrambling.
Right,
yeah, and so maybe birds would appreciate a bird feeder right now. Well, you're listening to the Larry Mueller Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're talking birds with Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert. You can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Amanda Magnus, our on-air producer, will get those messages into us. Talking birds with Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert, as we often do on holidays. And Noel and Bill, I'm going to play some of an indigo bunting. People can see if this sounds familiar at all. I have to say, I'm quite sure I've never seen one, and I'm not sure if I've ever heard one. So let's take a listen to the indigo bunting. So that's a pretty shrill sound, and then there's some kind of tisking in there as well.
Yeah, it tends to be a two-part note, and it is pretty distinctive, and people very often...
Hello?
Hello.
All right. So I think we just lost Noel.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I heard a little click there, and I thought you lost me as well.
Okay. No. So, Bill, what can you tell us about the indigo bunting?
Indigo bunting has these real rapid notes, so you'll hear people refer to it as sort of bubbly, or I've heard some describe it like he's got a marble in his throat or a bouncing ball, but you hear it, in my mind, I hear a real rapid, two notes, up and down, up and down. And it's got a little warble to it that you can hear, so there's sort of bounciness to it, very cheerful. The one reason why I like to point out indigo bunting call is because here's a bird that, when they first arrive, will come to bird feeders. They'll visit the feeders and take some seed. And then once the natural food becomes available, they seem to retreat up into the treetops. And I used to get this question all the time. Where do all the indigo buntings go? I get at my feeder for a week or two, and how far north do they go? All they do is go straight up. And when the leaves are so dense and full in the trees, they easily hide from sight. And that's why I like to point out that call, because you'll realize those indigo buntings are really all over the place. But you try to look for a little 4-inch bird in the top of a maple 30 feet up that's fully leafed out.
Sure.
You could spend all day trying to get a sight. It's an incredibly attractive bird. The other problem is indigo, as the name implies, refers to that brilliant blue color. Blue is not a pigment. So in other words, that color is really not produced by any protein. It's reflected light.
Okay.
So the color you get depends on the angle. When he's sitting down straight out of your window at a feeder, that light's bouncing off his back, and you get that deep bluish indigo color. You drive down the road, if he's sitting up on a telephone line...
and you're looking up at him.
Yeah, well, the light's bouncing off his back, he looks black. And
okay.
You'll miss him every time. But I drive around with the windows cracked open, and I hear indigo buntings all over the neighborhood.
Wow.
And so it's great to know him by song, because
yes,
it's the only way you're going to find him right now.
Great. Noel, you're back with us.
Yes, I'm back. I think the lightning got us.
I was going to say we were afraid that that you might have been sucked up by a storm or washed out of the office you're sitting in. So we were just talking a little bit about indigo buntings.
Yeah, I think Bill has probably answered it, but there is some words. I don't know if Bill mentioned the words you can put to the song.
No.
Because I mentioned they tend to be paired. Fire, fire, where, here, here.
Oh, okay.
So you might want to play it again to the folks if you can. And
yes,
to
absolutely.
See if you can kind of fire, where.
Okay,
here,
so here's the indigo bunting.
That helps people remember some songs.
All right, here's the indigo bunting. Fire, fire, where, here, here. All right. I'm not sure that my ear is well tuned enough, but I'm sure for some people they can. I have to say I'm quite a novice at bird watching and listening, and I'm trying to develop those skills. But it really is a skill, isn't it?
It is. And since I couldn't really hear it, I don't know if this particular clip had that kind of pattern or not. But
okay.
Yeah, people often ask, you know, how do you learn bird songs? And I mean, I'm still learning them here at 68 years old. There are some that I just don't know very well, and there's always some that stump me. There are some that are pretty similar to others. And, of course, there's all kinds of CDs out there you can listen to. But that kind of gets boring, and I don't think it really soaks in. I tell people the two best ways I know of is if you hear a bird, don't know what it is, track that bird down until you can actually see it and watch it sing. And it just seems like making that visual connection with being able to hear it, it just seems like it sticks with you more. And the other is to go out on a field trip with someone who is knowledgeable at a nature center or a state park or someplace where there's a field trip, and just hang on somebody's elbow and let them point out, and they can try to give you little hints about, you know, what it's sounding like or the habitat that you find the species in, and I think you'll pick them up quicker there than trying to sit down and just listen to a recording.
The other hints I would have is, first of all, it is difficult to get an ear for bird songs. It's like learning a foreign language.
Mm-hmm.
It's not easy. You try to study a foreign language, and you have to work at it. It takes practice. And also those little phrases that we use, some of them will really work well for you or somebody else. Others, I hear some of these phrases, and it just doesn't capture to my ear. It just doesn't work. There's others where somebody years ago gave me a phrase, and it's like, yeah, I'll never forget that, and that is it.
Mm-hmm.
And again, practice. The best thing I would do is, besides going out with field trips, start in your own backyard.
Mm-hmm.
The birds that you're going to hear all summer long, every single day. And as Noel says, when something catches your ear, get the binoculars, go out there, look at it. And then the other important thing is every time you hear it, just and don't just pass it off as background sound, tune your ear in and positively identify it. And every time you hear that, indigo bunting.
Mm-hmm.
That's indigo bunting. And then ask yourself, okay, if I hear that tomorrow, how will I know that that's indigo? What is it about the pattern, the rhythm, the tone quality, something that captures my ear? And if somebody gives you a phrase to help out, see if that doesn't help you as a little mnemonic phrase, reminder, if that doesn't clinch it. But it just takes a little practice. And the more you do it, you start to get a little more discriminating ear, where things that you thought sounded almost exactly like, you start to realize there's little nuances, and you can sift them out, and it's literally getting an ear for it.
And actually this morning, knowing that I was coming in to talk with the two of you, I did go outside and saw actually a pair of cardinals, a male and a female, sitting on the fence, and I knew that we had cardinal queued up as one of our audio clips, and so I paid careful attention. So this is a cardinal. So what is it that, for the two of you, that stands out for a cardinal?
Well, I hear a little birdie.
Cheer.
Okay.
That works for me. It's a nice, clear whistle. It's kind of upbeat. He's happy. He's a joyful one.
All right. Well, let's go to Matt in Liberty Pole next. Hi, Matt.
Hi. We have bluebird nests on the farm, and last night I found, I think it was the male, dead in the nest. I'm guessing sparrows got him. There was injuries around his head. And I guess my question is, the female is still there. She's got 5 eggs. Should I remove a couple of those eggs to give her a better chance to fledge those when they hatch? Because I know how hard those pairs work to feed them. And then the second part is, do you guys have any tips on English sparrow control? I've trapped and shot and pulled their nests out, and I just seem to keep them coming in frequently.
Now, house sparrows are certainly your biggest challenge in trying to bring off successful bluebird broods. And you know, I have one friend who has trapped about 18. He's got a very successful bluebird trail on a golf course, and I think he said he's trapped 18 house sparrows out of his trail this year. And you know, some places that can work pretty well, and you can get rid of really the troublesome birds. I do know a few other people will let the house sparrow, so they don't create havoc, like the one, since it had head injuries, it's kind of called sculling it, where how house sparrows will kill an adult in the nest. They'll go ahead and let a house sparrow nest in a box, but they'll just make a little hole in the egg so they never hatch. And the house sparrows spend all their time there trying to hatch their eggs without success, and they tend to leave the bluebirds alone a little bit more. Sometimes when you create havoc in a sparrow nest, it's almost like, well, I'll show you, and they go next door and wreak havoc on the bluebird nest that's in another box. But they're definitely a challenge. And if you're in a place, you know, in a dairy area or farm area where you have just lots and lots of house sparrows, and a large population to recruit from, it is very, very difficult to deal with them.
Also, I would not remove any of the eggs.
Right.
She will take care of whatever she can, and they'll fend for themselves. If she doesn't bring enough food, it'll be a little competition, and the healthier ones will outcompete. And it's not uncommon that not all of them do actually make it out of the nest in any year. And besides that, to be technical about it, federal law would prohibit you from actually meddling with the nest. And all birds are protected under federal law except for the exotic species. So if you are so inclined or find it necessary to have to trap or shoot something like a house sparrow or starling, you can. But, of course, we cannot do that with native birds.
All right. Thanks for that call, Matt. And I want to draw people's attention to a couple of things on our Facebook page. One, there's a photo of a vulture from North Dakota, and Steve is wondering what type of vulture that is. So we'll ask Bill to take a look at that. And also, Amanda was able to find and put a link up to the Northern Prairie Wildlife Research Center for some birdhouse plans. So that'll be very useful for a lot of us. We're talking about birds with Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright. They are both experienced and passionate birders with lots to share. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller. Few things convey a sense of place, of time of day, and of season more than the call of birds. But with this year's strange spring, we may get a little discombobulated by birds that are back early. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller. Thanks for spending your holiday here with us on the Ideas Network. Do you know where to look for different bird species nesting? What about what they do in order to stake out their territory? Our guests today are experienced and passionate birders, Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright. What bird questions do you have? Bill and Noel are happy to help when you call 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. And don't forget to check our Facebook page for updates and to post photos of birds you'd like help in identifying. Like the page while you're there and you'll get daily updates on upcoming show topics. There's so much to talk about with Bill and Noel. I hope you'll stay tuned. We'll be back right after this look at the news from NPR. Stay with us. Whether we know almost nothing about them or have studied them our whole lives, birds are fascinating. They add to our enjoyment of Wisconsin's great natural areas, not just by sight, but by sound as well. And we're lucky to have two experts with us today to help us know what we're seeing and hearing. Noel Cutright is a past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. As he told us earlier, he has been watching birds for 68 years. Great to get to talk to you again, Noel.
Thank you, Judith, and it's always great to try to respond to your listeners.
And Bill Volkert's been watching and studying birds for nearly 40 years, and in his travels has sighted more than 2,500 species. He was a naturalist at Horicon Marsh for 27 years. Bill, thanks again for joining us today.
Always fun to do it.
Well, let's go right back to the phones, because we do have a lot of people that would like to join in. So Doug in Madison is up first. Hi, Doug.
Hi. My question is, I have backyard bird feeders, and I still get purple finches. I saw a couple 2 days ago, and I have a bird book that said they migrate out in the summer. Is that correct, or do they stay here year-round?
Would you please take a look at your field guide and take a look at a picture of a house finch?
Okay.
A house finch, if you have an older field guide, it shows that house finches shouldn't even be here in Wisconsin, because they're a western species that was introduced on the Long Island about a half a century ago, and they've spread east. Now they occur in every county in Wisconsin and breed in every county in Wisconsin. So they're quite similar to two purple finches. Purple finches come down during migration in the wintertime, but typically they're not breeding, say, in Dane County.
So they would be gone already.
They should be gone. They should be in the northern third of Wisconsin where they do breed. So if you actually do have a purple finch at this time of year, it's probably because the bird has some kind of a problem.
Hmm.
But house finches are definitely here. They're a little bit more of a brick red, not kind of the raspberry purple or red that purple finches have. So just take a good look at a field guide with house finches, or go online, look up a house finch, and just see if that's what you might have rather than a purple finch.
All right. Thanks for that call, Doug. And Vic in Waukesha called to say that for him, the indigo bunting call, which we listened to earlier, sounds like a squeaky laundry line.
again, anything that works for you.
All right.
Like I say, there are some that will just clinch it. Others, you know, you'll just kind of shrug your shoulder and it just it may not quite connect.
Whatever works for us as individuals, right?
Absolutely. if it helps to nail it, stick with it.
There you go. Well, Rosie in Woodruff is up next. Hi, Rosie.
Hi. I just wanted to comment on the lady that was trying to identify between the Cooper Hawk and the Sharpshins. And I find them virtually just completely indistinguishable. And the only way I can do it is by the flight pattern. And when you were talking about the bird song saying, learn the rhythm and the pattern of the song, it reminded me, oh, that's how I know the difference between these two hawks, that the Sharpshin has a few beats of his wing and then glides a little bit. And maybe you could put a better picture to that, but that's generally how I can tell. Does that make sense?
Well, accipiters in general have that flap, flap, glide sequence. Sharpies will beat their wings faster than a Cooper's hawk, but both of them will have the flap, flap, glide pattern of flight.
Yes, and I'm sorry, I meant to say that it's the quickness of the beat for
okay.
me that sort of, I think
yes.
I'm getting them right, but that helps me a little bit sometimes when I can't, yes. they're not sitting still long enough to look at them.
But I thank you for bringing up the flight pattern, because acceptors, again, have flap, flap, glide, flap, flap, glide, versus just continually beating their wings or just soaring all the time like turkey vultures do. And I think that's probably the response about your vulture out in Dakota, that the only one they should have out there is a turkey vulture.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thanks for that call, Rosie. Darren Mercer emailed, for the last 6 years, when my husband and I arrive at our vacation house in Mercer, chickadees and nuthatches flocked to our bird feeder as we were filling it. We arrived on Saturday and filled the feeder, and not one bird has come. A merchant in town said the same thing with her feeders. What's going on? Bill?
I was hoping Noel would jump in.
Noel?
You always hear these pregnant pauses, and we're wishing the other one would take it, because
exactly.
when we don't have a good answer, we just don't say anything.
Sure.
Yeah, it's hard to explain sometimes why birds will come to feeders so readily, or sometimes just seem to ignore it. Whether there's just abundant natural food that they're just not even interested. You know, as we had earlier with the purple martin as well, you know, they were active at a house the previous year or this year. They looked at it and didn't seem to take to it. You know, these are birds of habit that sometimes it may be a little hard to explain. It's in a sense, say, with the Baltimore Oriole, people talk about grape jelly and oranges, that works so well. I know people who've had success with oranges, and a person across the street can't bring them in with an orange.
Mm-hmm.
And others say they can't keep up with enough grape jelly. I've tried grape jelly at my house, and they don't look at it. It spoils out there.
Huh.
Why is it that in some neighborhoods they just, like a magnet, they're on mm-hmm. it and just can't get enough, and others, they all but turn their nose up to it? I don't know.
Well, maybe there's a competing bird feeder in the area.
There you go. A better feeder.
Both nuthatches and chickadees should be right in the middle of raising young now, so maybe they built their nesting territories closer to another feeder, and they don't have to come
no.
to...
There you go.
Come to Doug's anymore.
Okay. Well, sorry.
Or
Sorry about that, Dar. But, you know, maybe I'm also guessing that maybe in another week she'll have some there. I mean,
I wouldn't give up hope at all.
Yeah. Great.
And that's another reason to keep the feeder out for the summertime, is it is a way to bring the young in. And if you've got some birds nesting nearby, as they start to leave that nest, it's kind of fun to see them at the feeder. The one reminder is don't fill it up too much in the summertime. Because if they're not eating it aggressively, you don't want it to sit there and spoil, especially in rain and high humidity. You don't have the molds growing on it. So the sanitation is going to become a little more important because birds can get a number of diseases from spoiled food. So
watch
that.
Good. That's a really good thing to keep in mind. Lance and Brown Deer is next. Hi, Lance.
Good afternoon. We have been watching a couple of crows in our backyard taking things, something they're going to eat, drop it in our bird bath, and then fish it out and eat it. What in the world are they doing?
They're preparing a meal, I guess.
I have to say, I could watch crows all day. I just think they're fascinating.
I have one doing the same thing in my bird bath, Lance. It comes and perches on an old rail fence in the back and then goes over to the bird bath and either drops it in or dunks it in. And
yep.
I'm not really sure what they're trying to do either. Maybe it's an old crow. Of course, I can't say they don't have any teeth, but
trying to soften things up.
Yeah,
a little bit.
personal preference, I think.
Or maybe it's a British crow that's trying to dunk something in its tea.
Yeah, I had a friend in high school who taught a crow to speak. Just something else. But,
wow. Well, Lance, you should take a video of that and put it up on the Facebook page so we can all enjoy it.
Okay.
That would be great.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lance. And let's go right to Jerry in Menasha next. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. When is it safe or not to stop or reduce feeding birds over the summer months? I could tend to supply them with water, but I want to tone down the feeding out there because I'm moving the feeders off my patio. I'm an apartment dweller. Mm-hmm. I want to put herbs out on that patio, and I'm tired of cleaning up the birdie doo-doo.
Okay. Well, let's let Noel and Bill respond to that. I think what you're going to say is pretty much anytime she wants to.
You're got it, Judith. you can quit any time. And as Bill mentioned earlier, you know, we think birds are really dependent on our feeders, and they're all going to die if our feed is no longer available. But all of these species are taking a large percentage of the food that they need on a daily basis from their surroundings. They're picking insects or eating seeds or whatever it might be that they need, and they're kind of coming to our feeders as supplemental feed, if you want to call it that. So you can, especially this time of year where there is abundance of invertebrates out there to feed on, you can just take them down today if you'd like.
All right. Well, there you go, Jerry. You can move on to your herb gardening anytime you want. Eric in Blue Mounds asked if you could please talk about whippoorwills. He'd like to know how to see them, how to attract them to his property, the types of habitats they require, whatever you can tell him.
That's a bird of real concern. They've been declining very significantly across eastern United States and certainly in Wisconsin. I know there are places where I would hear them regularly. I just don't. Seems like that range is contracting a bit. I think more in that southwestern part of Wisconsin, we still got a fair population. But, yeah, it's a bird of real concern, and we don't know what the problem is. Mm. Is it here on the breeding grounds? Is it problems in the wintering grounds? As I've always told people, the first thing to do is monitor the birds, see how they're doing. If we see a decline, the next real difficult thing is what is the problem and what can we do about it? And right now, I don't know if anybody's really put their finger on what the cause is for the decline of whippoorwill, but yeah, it is a bird that we just do not hear as we did in the past.
Hmm.
One of the things we are doing here in Wisconsin now is have some standardized routes set up to start monitoring populations so we can better understand where they're still abundant in the state or at least common, where they're declining, and over time we'll be able to kind of determine what's happening to their populations in the state. But as Bill mentioned, it's a real question right now on what is happening, other than we know they have declined. Some people have said, well, it's maybe all the exotic shrubs that have really kind of changed the way our woodlands look. Maybe it's a decline in the number of moths. I know I don't see the number of large moths flying at night when I'm driving the roads that I used to years ago. And their diet is comprised largely of, especially the larger moths. So it's just, we just don't know, but we're real concerned for them because so many of us grew up with whippoorwills nearby. And there are still places in the state that you can drive a road and hear 15 or 20 whippoorwills in, you know, a five-mile stretch of road. A week or so ago, we were down in the southern Kettle Moraine searching for a related species called the chuckwill's widow, which is a very rare species here in the state. We've had one or two appear back in Jackson County for the ninth straight year this year. And this one appeared right on the Walworth-Jefferson County line. And I went down with my son and a few other friends, and we heard it. This is another species that, talking to someone that's on the East Coast a little bit south, said their chuckwills widows are starting to replace their whippoorwills because it's a more of a southern species. We may start seeing more chuckwills widow come into the state. So it's one of the fascinating things about birds is trying to understand why they're increasing, why they're declining. And, of course, if they are declining, what we can try to do to change that trend.
And how the balance of one species might be affecting the balance of another and how that all fits together as well. Actually, I want to let people know that they're, well, first of all, that Bill and Noel, you're both already confirmed for coming back on the 4th of July. So we'll get to do this all over again in just a little over a month. And we certainly appreciate that. So listeners, you can mark your calendar for that. This Wednesday at 11, we've been doing a monthly segment in a series on the 40th anniversary of the Endangered Species Act. And this month's discussion will be about Kirtland's warblers. They returned to Wisconsin and set up nesting territory in May. And we'll be talking about the status of Kirtland's warblers and what's going on to protect them. And they're actually an example of really good collaboration and cooperation between agencies to really protect those birds. So that's Wednesday at 11. We'll be talking about that. And we are talking about birds with Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Larry Mueller today. Paul in Kenosha has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Paul.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Good.
Well, my question is this. I keep my boat in the Kenosha Harbor, and every year in May for about 2 weeks, two different kind of terns fly through the harbors, and they're always diving for fish. And so I was wondering if you could tell me, first off, what kind of terns these might be, and also if you could tell me more about their migration pattern.
Most likely common and Caspian tern would be my guess. Common tern looks a lot like the Forster's tern, which tends to be more in the inland marshes, where common terns we'll see out along the shores of the Great Lakes. Those two look an awful lot alike, but the Caspian tern is distinctly larger and readily identified. Common tern is an endangered species in Wisconsin. Caspian tern is a threatened species. So the habitat loss and contaminants have certainly been a problem for them, but that would be, my guess, is the most common ones that you might be seeing out there in migration.
Yeah, I would agree with Bill, and we're in the process of updating Wisconsin's threatened endangered species list that, now that Judith mentioned it, and one of the species that will be listed as a threatened species in the state is another tern, the black tern,
mm-hmm.
Along with... And I guess this is encouraging you to play the whistle of an upland sandpiper, Judith.
Yes.
Another species that used to be much more common in grasslands in Wisconsin. It's kind of an unusual shorebird that it doesn't really seek out mud flats or spend a lot of time around water. But it's another species that will now be listed as a threatened species in the state. And it has one of the neatest calls, I think, and we call it a wolf whistle. So,
well, let me go ahead and play that upland sandpiper right now so people get a sense of that. Here it is. Wow, that is a really distinctive call.
They have that warble call, but that wolf whistle is the one that, and it carries for a long mm-hmm. time in the open grasslands of the state.
There's a very sharp sound to it.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Well, thank you for that. And Noel, I'm thinking you should look over your shoulder and see if there's someone named Carl there, because we have a call from Governor Dodge.
Oh, it's probably Carl.
Hi, Carl.
Hi. Yes, we are indeed in Governor Dodge. We were helped get Noel down here today, but we've been birding while he's been on the radio. And we wanted to ask, why do birds sing so much more loudly after the rain? We were here during that shower, and once it stopped, birds really started singing again, including a Bell's Vireo.
Wonderful. That's one of the specialties here at Governor Dodge. It's also on the threatened endangered species list here in the state. It likes real thick, dense clumps of large shrubs, and there's some wonderful habitat here at Governor Dodge for that. It just seems like the rain, when they have to quiet down and shut up for a while, and when rain breaks, it just invigorates them for whatever reason. Just think how loud they are the first thing in the morning after being quiet all night. I think it's just... they haven't let their neighbor, the ones that are breeding anyone, they haven't let their neighbors know that they're still around for a while. One of the ways they defend their territory or announce their territory is to sing, to let their neighbors know that they're there. So maybe it's their desire to, again, let their neighboring species or their neighboring birds of the same species know that they're still there.
And I wonder also, after the rain, just like in early morning, that very still, calm, and maybe even somewhat moist air, that sound just carries so well. Same thing we'll find when the winds really pick up. Birds just shut up at that point. Why bother calling? Because there's so much rustling, it's not going to carry. So with that, I wonder if maybe it's just an opportunity that the conditions are right, that the sounds really carry, and take advantage of it.
All right. Thanks for that call. And I know, Bill, you can see the Facebook page.
Yeah, I was going to make a comment here. I see one from Scott in Madison.
Yes.
He says, we have a red house sparrow nesting. I think that would probably be the house finch that's nesting.
Okay.
And that larger speckled egg, well, that is a cowbird that dropped its egg into the nest for them to raise.
So the picture, for those of you that can't see it, it's a very nice picture. Thanks so much, Scott, for sending that in. It's a nest with four smallish white eggs and then one slightly larger white egg, but with heavy brown speckling. And so cowbirds, if I'm not mistaken, cowbirds are the only parasitic bird in Wisconsin?
In North America, yeah.
In North America, wow.
In Europe, you've got their cuckoos,
right.
Like the cuckoo clock. And around the world, there are a number of parasitic nesters. But, yeah, they've got a kind of an unusual habit, or some people think it was a nasty habit, that they drop their eggs in everybody else's nest for them to raise their kids.
So the cowbirds never actually raise their own?
No, they don't raise their own young.
Wow, that's really interesting.
Which really raises an interesting question, because they will then, the following year, have to call or find a mate. How do they know that song? I mean, it's pure instinct, because they have no chance to hear the parents at the nest practicing that song and be able to identify it.
Wow.
It must be just pure instinct that somehow they just, the following year, recognize that, hey, that's one of mine.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Very unusual. There's no chance to learn it otherwise from the parents.
Yeah, as Amanda, our producer, just said, it's nature versus nurture.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great.
And
well,
the one from Russ here showing looks like a camper with the bird on top.
Right.
I tried looking at that picture. It's a little distant, sort of whitish on the breast.
Right. It's very small in the picture. I mean,
I was squinting my eyes trying to look at that. I don't know. I could take a couple of guesses at it, but I almost hesitate to. Long shot might be Carolina Wren, but there again, I'm not seeing enough to say anything definitive. So,
well, we did want to let people listen to one other unusual bird that is declining in Wisconsin, the Western Meadowlark. And so let's take a quick listen to that. All right, that is a very distinctive call.
It's
as I mentioned,
more melodious than the Eastern Meadowlark. And as you've indicated, very much declining, and it's a bird that was much more common years ago. The western states, yeah, we'll see, you know, it's really the heart of the population. But to me, it's a little bit more warbled, flute-like, much more melodious, where the Eastern Meadowlark is just a plaintive little whistle, and you just hear that. So more plain, simple, where this one's got a little bit more warble, a little more chords to the song.
Mm-hmm. I just have to say that my complete lack of ability on whistling, I think, is going to hold me back as a bird watcher.
When we start
an ear for them, we have to imitate them all.
Okay.
When we started the breeding bird survey, the federal government started breeding bird routes throughout the United States. And when we started the ones here in Wisconsin in 1966, the Western Meadowlark was among the 10 most common birds in Wisconsin. Now you're challenged to find anyone, any single Western Meadowlark, you know, like east of the Wisconsin River. And you really need to search out prairies and grasslands to be able to find them. I know when we were doing the great Wisconsin Birdathon a week or so ago, we stumbled onto a field full of beef cattle up in the Buena Vista Marsh south of Stevens Point, and we were just serenaded by Western Meadowlarks, and it's the first ones I'd heard all year.
Wow. Well, we had a call, caller Beth from Waukesha, who was hoping to hear a white-throated sparrow, but I don't have that audio, so I will plan to grab that for July 4th, and we can play it then. And Bill and Noel, you can also give me some more suggestions for that, because I think people are enjoying that. So just in the last few seconds we have here, what are some good places in Wisconsin, say maybe southern, central, northern, where people can go and start bird watching?
Start with your backyard, for one, the local parks, certain times of the year along the Lake Michigan and Lake Superior shores are nice, southern, northern Kettle Moraine, the Baraboo Hills, Devil's Lake, the Mississippi River, the far north woods, lots of great places out there. Noel, he's certainly at one of them right now.
At Governor Dodge. And certainly, I think the idea of going to your backyard first is great. Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright, thanks so much for joining us today.
Always a pleasure to be with
Thank
you.
Thanks
so much for having us.
And we will be back tomorrow talking about allergies and also a visit from the weather guys. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Stay tuned to the Ideas Network.